Tears dripped to the ground, wondering how they'd appeared so quickly, like phantoms emerging from a misty morning. "I can't live like this," he thought, though it wasn't a desire to die. No, he was living for her, and that had to mean something. What he meant was something else, that he couldn't live here, in this new village, with these free-spirited people, because he didn't feel the same excitement they felt. His soul felt aged, like he'd lived 1,000 lifetimes in the span of a year. He knew he had to live another one, but not here. Mortis pulled the axe from its holster and dropped it in the boat. He would tell Bairn and his family, and the others from the caravan that had brought him this far. And then he would go. 1 month later. There was a reason the colonists from the west hadn't travelled further east than Portage thus far. The natives. When these lands had first been discovered, explorers had pushed toward all corners of it. The north had been found to be a cold and bleak place. Even the original discoverer, Heinrich Gehrig, had attempted to explore it, but his expedition had ended in tragedy, as he and most of his men perished on the frozen tundra. His son, Thomas, and several others survived, but refused to tell the tale. To the south, expeditionary forces had been met with significant resistance, and further expansion had been deemed impossible, at least for the time being. The east, however, had been a different story. The westerners had no problems crossing either the lake or the river, finding the east to be a hospitable land with good soil, lush grass, plenty of water, and a temperate climate. After what had happened in the south, each expedition was protected by a small military force, a mix of infantry, cavalry, and archers. The first such expedition that had attempted to travel from the lake to the eastern shore had not returned. The second achieved the same result. The third, however, had one survivor. The man claimed the natives to the east were witches and wizards, their hair infused with starlight, their eyes made from jewels of many colours, from which they got their power. "The rest of their bodies are constructed of iron," he'd said. Or at least, that was how the rumours and gossip back in Night's End had told it. He'd also claimed they'd let him survive, but he'd been made to promise to deliver a warning. Stop expansion to the east. There was no threat attached to the statement, but there didn't need to be. The lost expeditions were threat enough. For a time, more than a decade, all attempts to explore and colonize the east had ceased. But, as often happens, history is forgotten and children become men and women, determined to do something more than those who came before them. A fourth expedition departed for the east, determined to succeed where others had failed. It was a larger force than any of its predecessors, several hundred able-bodied soldiers who had survived skirmishes with the southerners on multiple occasions. They would return with the truth, it was said. None doubted them, least of all themselves. None returned. More time went by. Portage was founded by a small group of colonizers without military aid. They were content to settle on the eastern bank of the lake. None pushed further east. Until Mortis Ironclad. Not long after he'd departed Portage, he'd discovered a road of sorts, the grass trampled down, broken and greyed, until it was more dirt than anything else. The trail was arrow straight on what Mortis determined, after studying the position of the sun, was an easterly course. As he'd travelled, he saw not a single human, though the lands were home to a multitude of creatures, from spotted hares that dove into their burrows as he approached, to enormous elk with broad racks of antlers. He hadn't tried to harm any of the creatures, for he'd departed the colony with a sack heavy with dried meat and berries. The sack was lighter now, but far from empty. His waterskins were refilled by occasional rainfall, and he never thirsted. All in all, he'd enjoyed sleeping under the stars on the plains. Sometimes loneliness pressed in around him, but he fought it off with thoughts of discovering whatever lay to the east, even if it was the last thing he did. "Am I seeking death?" he wondered from time to time. After all, he knew the history of the four expeditions. "No," he said now. He spoke aloud, for it felt natural when one was alone. "I am starting fresh." But wasn't Portage starting fresh? Why wasn't it enough for him? Would anything ever be enough? or was he destined to walk these lands from sea to sea, from horizon to horizon, for the rest of his days? It was a question that nagged at him each and every day. Mortis stopped, finally seeing with his mind what he suspected his eyes had seen for a while now. An end to the flat grasslands. He squinted, trying to make sense of what he was seeing. Is that metal? Spires rose high into the sky, reflecting sunlight. Not one or two, or even a few, but hundreds, thousands. But these were no ordinary spires, for they had an asymmetry to them that seemed almost random, with beams shooting off to the sides at disjointed angles. Attached to the beams were millions of smaller, tiny sheets of metal. No, Mortis knew in his core. Not sheets, leaves. And the beams are branches, the spires, trunks. This was the secret the four expeditions had taken with them to their graves. An iron forest. From afar, the forest had seemed more fairy tale than reality. Up close, there was no doubt it was real. Mortis approached slowly, his eyes wide with wonder. There was no gradual shift from plains to forest. The first tree was several hundred feet high, and so broad around it would take a dozen men linked hand in hand to surround it completely. The bark, if he could call it bark, was completely smooth, and appeared no different than the face of an axe. Metal, he thought. There was no other way to describe it. He reached out to touch it, but stopped suddenly, his hand hovering a few inches away. Had the tree rippled? He swore he saw it move slightly, like a pond disturbed by a dragonfly landing on its surface. He shook his head, a nervous laugh escaping his lips. His mind was clearly playing tricks on him. Trees, whether made of wood or metal, didn't ripple. Solid things didn't carry the same characteristics as liquids. Without another thought, he touched the tree. His eyes widened as his finger sank into the surface, which hardened around it like water turned to ice in an instant. He tried to retract his hand, but it held fast. Panicking, he pulled harder, but stopped when pain shot from finger to wrist to forearm. There was no give at all. If he wanted to dislodge his finger, he'd have to snap the bone in half. His breath tight in his throat, his heart hammering. Mortis stared at the tree, trying to decide what to do. He was all alone. Even if he could muster the courage to remove his own finger, he had no blade. He couldn't imagine the pain of trying to snap his bones and wrench his shattered flesh from the tree. And then things got worse. Further along the tree's metal surface, something moved, an iron tendril darting out and grabbing his other hand. He cried out, fighting against the force, but it was impossibly strong, dragging his hand into the tree where, once more, it stuck. Again, he tried to pull it out, but this time his efforts only made his arm sink further in, up to his elbow. Desperation gripped him as tightly as the tree. It all became clear to him in an instant, how those prior expeditions had vanished without a trace. The lone survivor had ranted about people made of metal and starlight, but what he'd seen were these ravenous iron trees eating his companions alive. And this one was about to devour him, pulling him inside its liquid metal surface until he no longer had air to breathe. "I'm sorry, Scarlet," he thought. "I'm sorry I didn't do better with my new life. I'm sorry I couldn't offer you more." One of his legs had been yanked into the tree now, but he barely noticed as he craned his head back to look up at the sky one more time. His eyes, however, focused not on the sky, but on an unexpected form, sitting high on a metal-sheathed branch. Her hair was made of starlight, and her eyes as bright as jade. She appeared to be formed of metal, almost like another branch of the tree. She held a tall iron bow with the familiar grace of one who'd done so for years. She smiled, and it was a young smile, a contradiction to her colourful eyes, which seemed full of the kind of experience one could only get from the passage of years. And then she pulled back the bow, an arrow already nocked. "Duck," she said, and then she fired. Even if Mortis had had the presence of mind and time to duck, He wouldn't have been able to. His arms and legs held fast by the liquid iron tree. That's when the strangest thing happened. Time slowed down. He could see the approach of the arrow, which seemed to be fully constructed of iron, from tip to shaft to feather-like tail. He saw the rotation of the shaft, saw the sharp tip as it flew toward him. Seconds passed, and it moved so slowly he could have reached out and snatched it from the air if he had the use of his arms. Instead, it would be a painfully slow death, every beat of his heart moving the dart an inch closer. Its aim was true, and there was no way to avoid it. He refused to blink, his eyes burning. His eyes crossed as it moved directly between them, moments from splitting his skull in two. This was it. And though it wasn't the end he had imagined, at least he had seen this place. Time stopped completely. He stared at the tip of the arrow, which hovered before him, frozen. And then, like a memory replayed in reverse, it rocketed backwards, high up into the tree, where the Iron Woman caught it, a laugh falling from her lips. Mortis managed a shuddering breath. He was still alive, for now at least. "Who are you?" he asked. The woman's laugh vanished. "The stranger comes into our wood and begins asking questions. Humans." She spat the last word out like a bitter taste. Mortis was still held fast by the tree, but at least it wasn't actively trying to entomb him any longer. He wondered if the woman had something to do with that, or if the tree had decided to spare him. Also, was she really a woman? She was unlike any woman he'd ever seen before. The pupils of her eyes were too narrow, black ovals amidst an effervescent green sea. He struggled to find words. "Why did you come here?" she asked. Why did I come here?" Mortis wondered. Nothing about his decision to leave Portage was logical. Yes, he could tell himself it was to get even further away from those who might still pursue him, but that was a lie. "I couldn't be around people any more." His own words shocked him. Was that the truth? And if so, what did that mean for the rest of his existence, however long that may be? She seemed surprised by the response as well. "The others came to steal our lands. They came with soldiers and weapons." "You killed them?" she shrugged. "In a manner of speaking. Ironwood does not like strangers." Information that would have been useful before he'd touched the tree. "I got that." She chewed her lip, seeming to consider the situation. Then she slung her bow onto her back and swung her body over the branch. She dropped into empty space, and his breath caught, because the height was too great for anyone to survive. Tendrils of liquid ore shot from the tree, and she caught one, released it, and twisted in the air, catching another with her knees. Several more twists and acrobatic maneuvers, and she landed just before him. Mortis stared. He couldn't help himself. What he could see of her skin was like fine porcelain, nestled between the curving lines of her armor. For that's what it was, he realized now. It wasn't that she was made of iron, it was that she was wearing iron. From a distance, the mistake was easy to make, because Mortis had never seen armor so exquisite. Fitting her lithe body so perfectly, it must have been forged directly onto her skin. Which was impossible, because she'd be burned to death while the ore was shaped. "Is there something on my face?" she asked, feeling around with mock interest. I'm sorry. It's just, I've never seen such armor. Nor a woman with the eyes of a cat, nor hair like starbeams and silk." "Of course you haven't," she said. "Only the Aurians can channel the ore of the forest." "Channel?" She ignored the question. "Tell me why I should let you live." He gaped. The way she said it was as easy and light as if she were asking him if she could borrow a cup of sugar. I don't know," he said. Her eyebrows arched, and an unimpressed smirk filtered across her lips. "That's your answer? The others begged, threatened, and tried to charm us. And they failed, right?" She seemed to concede the point. "You don't have any weapons," she said. He shook his head. I'm not here to fight. Then why are you here? Again, it was a question he wished he knew the answer to. The only response he had was, I walked. She closed her eyes and took a deep breath. He could tell she was tiring of the conversation. When she opened them again, irritation flashed. Why did you walk? Answer me or die. It would be so easy. Give another cryptic answer and she would shoot him with an arrow, for real this time. Maybe there was a place after this life. Maybe Scarlet was there. It would be so easy. But Mortis, despite all he'd been through, didn't want to die. So he told her the truth, all of it, starting with, My name is Mortis Ironclad. When he'd finished, she no longer looked angry. She looked at him differently, though he couldn't tell whether the change was positive or negative. She said, My name is Sparrow Storm, and you are my prisoner. The tree had released Mortis, but neither his hands nor feet were completely free, shackled together with iron manacles. Now he marched through the magnificent iron forest, Ironwood, Sparrow had called it, an appropriate name, gazing at the wonders that surrounded him. It wasn't only the trees that caught his interest, though they were impressive. The ground itself was iron in many places, spotted with sections of dirt from which plants grew. The smaller ones were mostly green, leafy things, but the larger they grew, the more the iron covered them. It was impossible, he said, shaking his head. His body felt light, despite the iron cuffs he wore, like he'd entered a dream. You say impossible, even though you see with your own eyes? Foolish human. Sparrow's eyes narrowed on him, and he thought he knew how a mouse felt trapped under a cat's paw. You call me human, which means you are not human, she said. Not fully. Then what are you? Orion? My people have lived in this forest for thousands of years, before we understood the ore. Before we could channel it. You mean control it? No, I mean channel it. Why must humans control everything? Life should be a partnership. If everyone understood that, there would be no war, no violence. Forests would flourish rather than being chopped down. Mortis felt his cheeks warm. He was suddenly glad he'd decided to leave his axe behind. After all, what good would an axe be in a forest made of iron? A different kind of feeling struck him, too, a more abstract one. Who am I? His entire life he'd been a woodcutter. But who is a woodcutter without trees to fell? His thoughts disappeared when Sparrow said, You are Crimean, no? I come from Crimea, he said. She frowned, her thin eyebrows like silver rainbows. I don't understand the distinction, he sighed. People like me came seeking a new life, a new place. We remained Crimeans for a while, but then there was a war of independence. We won. She nodded, understanding filling her expression. And now you seek to take our independence. There was venom in the statement, and Mortis couldn't blame her. There are those who are never satisfied, he said slowly. She stopped, and he did the same. But you are satisfied? I was, he said. Before this Lord Farley Loren murdered the woman you loved? The words were almost worse than if she'd shot a dozen arrows into his chest. He bit his lip and nodded. She shook her head and continued walking. Savages, she muttered. He couldn't argue with that, even as he blinked away tears and followed. 1 week later. Being Sparrow's prisoner was better than it sounded. Though he was kept in a cage, formed of iron, of course, which seemed to shift and change whenever he wasn't looking, it was open to the fresh air. A warm breeze passed between the bars. The cage was nestled in the boughs of a tall tree, well above the forest floor. At first, the height was dizzying, but Mortis soon grew accustomed to it, appreciating how far he could see through the jumble of trees. And there was much to see. The animals, for one, were a beautiful curiosity. Butterflies with iron-sheathed wings danced and played on the wind around his cage, occasionally settling on his fingers, staring at him with strangely intelligent eyes. The first time he'd seen an oarhawk land on a nearby branch, with its broad silver-tinged wings and regal neck and scalp, it had taken his breath away. And though waking up in the dark to a pair of glowing eyes was somewhat discomforting, Mortis had even learned to appreciate the oar panthers, even if he sometimes felt like they would eat him if Sparrow hadn't told them not to. The only animal he hadn't seen yet was an oar monkey, and though the Orion children often called him one, he was beginning to believe they didn't truly exist. The children were looking at him now, as they often did, giggling and daring each other to go closer to his cage. Their hair was dark and only beginning to glisten with streaks of vibrant colours like the adult Orions. Their eyes were, however, cat-like, but the colour was only beginning to come in, pale lavenders and oranges and sunflowers. "I won't bite," Mortis said, though they never believed him. "My teeth aren't even sharp." He bared his teeth, and they screamed and ran away, fighting for a space on a narrow iron walkway that connected with a platform on the next tree. The entire forest seemed to be tethered together by the ore bridges, which allowed its inhabitants to cross large distances without ever setting foot on the ground. It is no wonder the previous expeditions never stood a chance, he thought. They couldn't fight an enemy they couldn't see. An enemy, he thought, watching the children scamper away. Is that what the Orions were to humans? Or had they made them their enemy by invading their lands with steel and helm? Another form came into view, though she refused to use the walkways, channeling the oar into long vines that she gripped with only a single hand as she swung toward him. Sparrow's long silver hair caught the wind behind her, stretching out like a cape. When she reached the peak of her swing, she released the vine, somersaulted twice, and then landed atop his cage. The oar shifted, and a hole began to open. Her feet came first, then the rest of her, and she landed beside him. Oar trailed from her fingertips, but was swiftly channeled back into the roof, sealing it once more. Watching Sparrow in action never failed to cause Mortis's heart to skip a beat. "The others want to kill you," she said without preamble, a tiny smirk already on her lips. Such threats no longer sent fingers of fear up his spine the way they did at the beginning of his captivity. In fact, they were part of his daily routine now. "I eat threats for breakfast," he thought, accepting a piece of fruit that Sparrow handed to him. He bit into the plum, which was as sweet as a handful of sugar. "They should probably kill me, then," he said, still chewing. "There's juice on your chin," Sparrow said, gesturing. He shrugged. "I'm going to die, so—" She laughed. "That's not what I said. You're mine, and no matter what they say, it's my decision." Mortis knew it should have been disconcerting and offensive to be thought of as a possession, but it wasn't, at least not yet. Perhaps it is the magic of this place. "But why? Why haven't I killed you? I don't rightly know. No, I mean, why am I your prisoner? For what purpose?" Another laugh. "I get bored easily, and you're interesting." "Interesting how?" "Like a new bug," she said, shrugging. "I might be a century old, but that doesn't mean I don't like to have things to play with." "Wait, what?" "You didn't know. I figured one of the children would have told you by now. Orions are fully grown by 16, and then don't age much physically until they're at least a century and a half old." Mortis couldn't be certain whether she was playing him for a fool or not, but he'd seen enough wonders from these people that he knew not to doubt her. "I'm 32, he said. "Wait, 33, I think. Time passes differently now." She looked at him, her gaze never wavering. It was something she did sometimes, and he learned not to look away. It once made him uncomfortable, but not any more. Finally, she said, "Time passes the same as it always did. You just perceive it differently." Logically, he knew that, but it didn't feel that way. He waved the truth away, juice dripping from the plum. Took another bite. "You can't keep me locked up forever," he said. "Can't I?" He shook his head. "I'll die of old age before you ever do, and then you'll be stuck with a rotting corpse. The smell alone. Can you imagine? Are all humans so amusing? She asked. Nay, just me. Are you ready for your history lesson? He was. Over the last week, Sparrow had taught him the Orion's history, from over a century ago when the forest was just a forest, and they were just like humans, but with better hygiene habits, Sparrow liked to joke. He learned how the mistakes of a foolish man had unwittingly unlocked the secrets of the forest's underground ore deposits, how over centuries they'd learned to channel the ore, and the changes it had wrought in them, from their hair and eye color, to their physical prowess, to their long lives. Today we're talking about humans, she announced. Mortis frowned. I already know about humans, but not why we hate them. When she spoke bluntly like this, it always stung. Though Mortis had seen the great kindness her people could offer, he'd also seen the potential for harsh action, hidden behind their japes and laughter. Because we must control things, he said, remembering what she'd said the first time he'd met her, the day he was almost eaten by a tree. Because you must conquer, she corrected. He couldn't argue with that. Even his own people, the Crimeans, had sought to conquer the colonists when they tried to break free. And the colonists had tried to conquer the south and the east. It was the way of men, he knew. We're not all like that, he argued. The only thing he'd wanted was Scarlet's heart, and even that had been taken away from him. By a man who wanted to conquer her, he realized. Anger flowed through him, as it often did when he thought about Lord Farley. The anger was the only thing keeping him from shattering like crushed glass. Well, and these daily history lessons, he had to admit. His anger faded when he felt a hand on his shoulder. Sparrow had moved closer and was looking at him, touching him. She leaned forward and kissed him. For a moment he was stunned, the warmth of her lips against his, and he wanted nothing more than to fall into her, to move against her, to feel her arms around him. He pulled away, shoving her back, shocked by the intensity of his feelings. She must have done something, used the magic of this place, or the ore, something, to bewitch him. What are you doing? He said, wiping at his mouth. The mouth that had only ever known the lips of one other woman. Though he scrubbed at his lips, he could still taste Sparrow, sweet and fruity from her breakfast, and he hated that it was a good taste. Her eyes narrowed. She's dead, Sparrow said, and though the words were cruel, her tone was not. Only matter of fact. I am not. Why be alone? She didn't look angry at having been rejected. Not at all. More than anything, she looked curious. And you're interesting, like a new bug. Her words and the neutral manner in which she spoke them only angered him more. I don't want to replace her. I don't want anything. Leave me alone. She licked her lips, seeming to consider. Those lips that had tasted so frustratingly good. Somewhere deep inside him, Mortis had known Sparrow was beautiful, devastatingly beautiful. But until now it was as if his mind and heart hadn't processed it. But now... Go, he said again. She shook her head. I will not. We haven't finished your history lesson. For the rest of the day, she talked about war. To Mortis's surprise, learning about the wars of Orions and men snuffed out what was left of his anger, leaving him cold inside. 3 months later. Mortis was no longer a prisoner. He hadn't been for some time. And though some of the Orions still glared at him when they saw him, even pretended to knock invisible arrows to invisible bows and shoot him through the throat or eyes, most were pleasant, even kind to him. He did his best to help them, learning to climb the tall trees into the highest boughs to find the sweetest fruit, offering them into the general supply and accepting his portion. They didn't need him to collect the fruit, as any of their children could do so far more efficiently than he, but that wasn't what mattered. What mattered was that he tried. Sparrow, to her credit, had never tried to kiss him again, nor had she held any grudge. They were fast friends, spending long hours in each other's company. He'd taught her about the ways of humans, and she'd reciprocated with lessons in archery and demonstrations of ore channeling. She'd even introduced him to her favourite ore panther, which had apparently wanted to eat him for some time, but which would now make an exception. Lucky me, he'd thought. Now, Mortis hung from a long vine just beneath Sparrow. The vine was swinging at breakneck speed, hurtling for one of the platforms. Jump! Sparrow cried, and Mortis did, because the only other choice was to slam into the metal trunk of the tree. He flew through the air, his arms flapping wildly as if they would turn into wings and help him cover the distance. The distance, which now appeared impossibly far. Still, his weight and momentum carried him forward, and for a moment he thought he might make it. But then he didn't, his fingertips scraping against the platform's edge, unable to gain purchase as he slid away. Sparrow landed above him with the barest of thumps and reached for him a second too late, only able to watch him fall. His scream lodged in his throat, and his heart smashed into from behind, followed quickly by his lungs and stomach. With a jolt, his fall was arrested by something that gripped his ankles hard enough to hurt. He twisted upside down and swung awkwardly, narrowly avoiding a collision with a tree. Like a pendulum finishing its arc, he stopped, before gaining momentum in the opposite direction, once more brushing past the tree with mere inches to spare. When he finally stopped swinging, he found himself staring up at Sparrow, who channeled the ore rope back up to her fingertips, setting him gently on the platform on his back. He looked up at her, and every detail seemed magnified. Her eyes not just green, but turquoise, too, like the waters of the ocean near the shore. The silver hairs of each brow etched in perfect lines to create the whole of each arch, which mirrored her expression so closely. Her lips, pale pink, in the shape of the wings of a butterfly. The crest of her armor as it curled around her chin, her ears, her brow. "Thank you," he said. "You're welcome," she said. "Shall we go again?" She smiled. "Aye, but try to land on the platform this time." 10 years later. When Mortis Ironclad thought back over the years, they seemed much like the wind. Remembered, felt, but unseen, moving so quickly they were gone before he could catch them. The last decade of his life had been good, pleasant even. Though he would never be an Orion, they had accepted him into the fold, or at least learned to live with his presence in Ironwood. In the early days, Sparrow had warded off any threats, and eventually she didn't need to any more. Ironwood felt like home now, a thought that surprised him. Strange that a woodcutter would find happiness in a forest of metal. Then again, he was no longer a woodcutter but an architect. His field of expertise was iron defences. Though he didn't have the ability to channel ore himself, he knew forests, having spent most of his life within them. And he knew humans, who continued to be the greatest danger to the Orion's way of life. Their primary enemy was the Calypsians, who apparently had a growing brood of new dragons, which they called the Dragonia. Once they were full size, history told there was every possibility they would attack. A lesser threat came from the west, where the independent colonists continued to expand further and further across the plains. "At least they haven't sent more military forces," Mortis often thought. He'd become a student of history, learning every detail about the wars of the past, the victories the Orions had won, and the defeats they'd suffered, and how to overcome the tactics of both the Calypsians and Crimeans, if it came to that. Daily, he worked with the top Orion ore channelers to build ore defences into their borders. He wanted Ironwood to feel like a fortress, so the occupants could feel safe. "And so I can feel safe," he admitted inwardly, watching as a new shield defense was tested against a full battery of Orion archers. Positioned off to the side, he held his breath, hoping for more success than the last test. Once he'd believed Ironwood to be impenetrable, but that wasn't really true. The ore defenses were only as good as the Orions channeling the iron, and Orions could be killed. The more who fell under an enemy attack, the weaker the defenses became, which was why proper shielding was so important. The archers fired, aiming at different heights, a common tactic used by the Calypsians. Broad shields burst from the trees, shooting out in sheets and connecting, creating more of a wall than a collection of shields. Arrows deflected off the metal, falling harmlessly to the ground. Even the highest arcing shots were blocked. But that was the easy part. Mortis released his breath slowly, watching as the Aurean attackers split into two separate forces racing in opposite directions, trying to flank the newly established wall. High above the ground, the Aurean channelers took off, charging along the narrow bridges that now spanned the entirety of this side of the forest. As they ran, they extended the wall, gritting their teeth as they poured everything they had into the effort. Behind them, the wall vanished. In a real battle, more channelers would be used so the wall could be kept intact, or at least that was the thinking. Mortis wondered how many channelers it would take to stop an army of 1,000, or 10,000. And if they had dragons. He swallowed the thought, concentrating as the split groups of archers fired once more. This time they shot on the run, which was a skill it was likely their enemies would not be able to mimic, but they could perhaps shoot from horseback or from the backs of their guanic, the reptilian beasts the Calypsians favored, which Mortis had never seen. Once again, the arrows were deflected, save for perhaps a few that slipped past just ahead of the growing wall. The test continued like that for an hour, with different tactics used by the archers to breach the defenses. When the test was finished, it was deemed an outright success. 9 arrows got through, Sparrow announced, holding them bundled together in a fist. She wore a smile as she strode toward him, her gait lithe and graceful. She looked much the same as she had when he'd met her a decade earlier, though her hair was longer now. She'd finally cut it only after it had surpassed her waist. Sparrow was his best friend and partner on the defense project. Better than 900, like last time, he said as she stopped, dropping the metal arrows to the ground at his feet. She snorted. Aye, we're making progress. He could hear the unspoken words behind the statement. But it's not enough. Mortis wondered how it could ever be enough. Ironwood was simply too large to defend. Their enemies could come from any direction at any time. And if they had dragons. We need more channelers, Mortis said. There are no more. That he knew. Although every Aurean was born with the ability to channel ore, he'd learned over time that some had a greater propensity for it. Only the best were able to perform at the level of channeling required for their defenses. Sparrow was one of them. Mortis ran a hand through his hair, which was beginning to sprout stalks of grey. Unlike the Aurians, he felt he was growing older by the day, his bones creaking, his muscles sore. We will work with what we have, he finally said. Sparrow was standing so close, it would be so easy to reach out and touch her. Easy, but not simple. He resisted the urge, and she stepped back. It was so like her to realize the moment he became uncomfortable, and though she laughed it away and feigned a punch to his shoulder, Mortis knew her well enough to see the slight hurt she felt, her cheeks pinking. He wanted to say he was sorry he was haunted by ghosts. He wanted to say he was sorry he wasn't a better man. Instead, he said nothing, and she turned away, off to debrief the channelers. After a moment of listening to his heart pounding twice as fast as usual, he followed her. Mortis didn't know why he'd been summoned before the Aurean Council, but he couldn't think of any good reasons. They've finally decided to banish me. They're going to forbid me from seeing Sparrow. They're going to put me back in a cage. They were ridiculous thoughts that had no anchor in reality, but he couldn't keep them from rattling around in his brain. The broad iron pathway through the forest seemed to narrow, though Mortis was fairly certain it was his imagination, because just as he felt the trees closing in, the trail spilled into a large clearing. He didn't require measurements to be certain it was a perfect circle, ringed by iron trees that felt more like columns. Pillars that seemed to hold some unknown weight from coming crashing down on his head. The council awaited, a group of 5 comprised of 1 man and 4 women. He approached the armored group of Aurean elders, their combined age exceeding 1,000 years, subconsciously sticking out his chin and preparing for the worst. Then he spotted Sparrow standing off to the side, and he flinched, stopping. She wasn't old enough to be an elder, and they rarely invited guests to their councils. Yet she is here. The look on her face was surely intended to be neutral, a practiced expression of nonchalance that once, many years ago, he would have had trouble reading. But not any more. Now he could lift away the shroud and see the barest hint of fear in her narrowed eyes and pursed lips. Suddenly, all the worst-case scenario thoughts fell away, replaced by something darker and full of shadows. "What has happened?" Mortis said. The unspoken leader of the council, Sandspool, beckoned him forward, but Mortis's feet felt impossibly heavy, like they'd been surrounded by the ore that ran beneath him like an underground river. Sandspool sighed. She was a tall and wiry woman, as many of the Orion were. Her hair was jet black, but with natural streaks of gold. Her eyes were the color of fire.
"Your people are gathering to the west," she said.
She leaned forward slightly, as if she wanted to step closer, but was as stuck as Mortis felt. "Your people." It was one of several habits that even time had been unable to break. "They aren't my people," Mortis said. "They haven't been for a long time."
"But you don't want to kill them."
It sounded more like a statement than a question, but Mortis felt compelled to answer anyway.
"Do you? Why does anyone have to kill anyone?"
He knew he sounded naive, but he didn't care. On one tumultuous night, more than 10 years ago, he'd had more of death than one lifetime should have.
"If they attack Ironwood,
then we must defend ourselves. Of that we are in agreement. But they haven't, not yet." He was being naive again, but it was the only way he'd managed to do his job for so many years. He preferred to believe it was the Calypsians who would eventually attack, not the Westerners. One of the other council members, Jenai, placed a comforting hand on Sandspool's shoulder. If Sandspool reminded Mortis of fire, Jenai was ice, her hair pale blue with eyes to match. The two women were bondmates, and regardless of their age, as a pair they were a force to be reckoned with.
"This isn't why we asked you here," she said.
"Right, of course not. This was never meant to be a conversation, nor a debate." "Then your decision is made," he said. He couldn't keep the bitterness from his tone.
"You misunderstand," Jenai said. "Please reserve your comments until you have heard the full story."
He gritted his teeth, blowing his breath out through his nostrils, but nodded. Sandspool said,
"As you know, we have spies across the spear."
He did know, and they brought back tales of expansion, colonies springing up month by month, year by year, pushing further east, like a net closing in on Ironwood. He said nothing, waiting for her to continue.
"The West is changing. Verna Garrick is dead, and
he's been dead for a year, and his son..." This was old news, word of the Western ruler's passing fading away months ago.
"His son is no longer in Night's End," Sandspool said,
before he could continue his thought.
"Oh, no."
Though the elder Garrick was an old man and would have never left the capital city, the younger would have boundless energy. He would want to build his legacy. Conquest was one way to do that.
"He's not leading an army," Sandspool said,
as if she'd read his mind.
"He's gone north."
"What?"
"He is exploring the north, as his great-grandfather once did. He has no interest in ruling."
Though little was known about Heinrich Gerich's death, it was a story often told around campfires, embellished over the years, as all good stories are. After all, the man had been a legend, a hero. Most believed him one step short of a god.
"But that means..."
Jenai nodded sharply.
"Yes. Rule of the West has passed to another house."
Everything about this moment coalesced into a single point, the facts lining up in Mortis's head. Focused on the conversation, he'd almost forgotten Sparrow was there, but now her presence felt like the only thing that mattered. His eyes found hers, but she couldn't meet his gaze, something that only served to hammer the nail down harder.
"Which house?"
he growled, though he already knew.
The Lorens, Sanspool said. Lord Farley Loren, to be exact.
Mortis sat as still as stone, though his heart was pounding so quickly he might have been running. Sparrow sat beside him, that invisible line between them, as it always was.
What are you going to do? She asked.
The words came out so easily he wondered whether they were true.
Kill him.
They must be true. How could they not be? After all, Farley Loren had taken everything from him. Sparrow only nodded, going quiet. Mortis wanted details now. After the council had told him the truth, he'd been too blindsided to ask anything. He'd begged his leave and departed, Sparrow hurrying after him, falling in beside him, knowing him well enough not to speak until now. They sat on a high branch on one of the border trees, looking westward. The plains were so empty, Mortis could almost make himself believe they were the only two people in the entire world. He almost wanted to believe it. But he couldn't, for he'd dreamed such a dream once, and it had been ripped away from him in a single night.
"I will kill him," he said.
Sparrow said nothing. The sun rose somewhere behind them, casting long pink lines overhead.
"When will they reach us?"
he finally asked, a question he'd been avoiding.
"Soon," she said.
"When?"
"If they do not stall their march. Dusk tomorrow, at the latest."
Holy awe! Mortis didn't often think about the Orion god, Orion, preferring to think of Ironwood as a place of amazing but natural properties, rather than a blessed forest touched by a god. Suddenly, he felt frantic.
"We must prepare the defences," he said, standing on the branch.
Once the height would have dizzied him, made him cling to the surface like a lifeline. Now he stood perfectly balanced, as comfortable as if he were on flat ground.
"Mortis," Sparrow said.
He didn't look at her. Couldn't.
"No. Don't do that. This is what we've been preparing for. Calypsians, Westerners, it doesn't matter. We are under attack and we must—"
"Mortis, stop." Though it was uttered softly, coming from Sparrow it felt like a command. He didn't want to stop, because if he stopped, the memories of that night would surround him like so many enemies. The anger would return, which was really masking the sadness, that dark place he never wanted to return to.
"Sparrow, I can't talk about. I don't want to."
Every word only brought him closer to the darkness. He sank back down beside her, mute.
"I don't want to talk about it either," she said.
Slowly, tentatively, she scooted closer to him. Her leg didn't touch his, but it almost felt like it did. Her arm wrapped around him, and then he was falling. His head touched her hard iron chestplate, his tears dripping down until the metal glistened in the early morning light.
"You won't even need to fight," Sparrow said,
watching as two Orion channelers fitted him with armor. Though he'd seen other Orions don armor before, including Sparrow. To see the liquid metal climb his legs, sheathe his torso, surround his chest and arms. Perhaps he'd been too quick to dismiss the Orion god as fancy. Being given the armor was the highest honor for an outsider, one that had been granted to him by the council. He felt remorseful for misjudging their original intentions, but that was the least of his feelings at this moment. "We all have to fight," Mortis said, turning to face her. He met her piercing eyes without embarrassment for his behavior earlier that morning. The years had pushed them far beyond such pointless emotions. And the invisible line he'd always felt, that he knew he'd created, between them, it was gone. She felt nothing other than friendship for him. If there had ever been anything else, he'd chased it away long ago.
"That's how it has to be. How it must be."
"Not if the defences hold," she said.
"They won't."
"How can you be so certain? We fought the Westerners before and always emerged victorious." He shook his head. How could he explain the difference between human men to a woman who grew up in this magical place? Where the Garricks had always been fair, a long line of explorers only interested in freedom for their people and the opportunity to explore new lands. The Lorens, or at least Farley Loren, were interested only in the pursuit of power. This will be different. They will come to destroy us. For a moment, she looked like she might argue further, but then closed her mouth, her eyes roaming from his head to his feet and back again, until her eyes settled on his once more. "It suits you," she said. When his brows furrowed, she clarified. "The armor." "Oh." And there it was, the reason for the line, that electrical current passing between them, his own eyes falling to her lips, to the swell of her breast beneath her armor, the curve of her hips, the tenderness in her tone. "But don't get a big head about it," Sparrow added, with a laugh that seemed to break through the current. "On the morrow, you'll be a mere human again." Mortis faked his own laugh, though all he wanted to do was cross the span between them. He didn't. Instead, he turned toward the two channelers that had given him this great gift. "Thank you," he told them. They bowed and departed without another word. He almost wished they would have stayed. "I have something for you," Sparrow said. The earnestness in her tone made him fear to turn toward her. Feared what he would do. "What?" he asked, without looking. "This." He finally turned, to find her holding a double-bladed axe constructed entirely of iron. She held it out like an offering to the gods. He hesitated for only the barest of moments, before stepping forward to take it from her. Their fingers brushed slightly, sending a shiver along his skin. His muscles tightening slightly, he studied the axe. It was of exquisite craftsmanship, the dual blades sharpened to a fine edge. The handle was a work of art, roped with vines, carved with the wonders of ironwood. Oar-hawks soaring, oar-panthers loping, iron-sheathed butterflies dancing on invisible breezes. "It's beautiful," he murmured. "I'm glad you like it." Another thought struck him, the realization finally sinking in. All his life, save for the last decade, he'd hefted axes, cutting countless chunks of wood for fuel, for timber, for art. But this was no tool of utility. No, this axe was a weapon. And she wanted him to use it to kill Lord Farley Loren. There was a nervous energy in the air as they watched the approaching army. The channelers had been in position for long hours, waiting. Mortis was amongst them, on one of the platforms, prepared to give orders to the defenders once the battle began. Night fell like a dropped curtain weaved of shadows. Mortis felt nauseous, but he held back the swell of his stomach with sheer will. Though he was no warrior, he wasn't afraid of the impending battle, nor dying. He was afraid of the past, and though there was no guarantee Lord Farley himself would ride into battle, in the core of Mortis's heart he knew he would. "The man won't be able to help himself. He will risk his own life in the hopes of emerging as a conquering hero." He also knew, however, that Farley wouldn't be at the front. He would try to swoop in at the last moment, when victory was all but assured, claiming all the spoils for himself. This knowledge chased away the nausea, replacing it with the coals of a fire that had been smoldering for years, only to be rekindled now. And Mortis couldn't wait for the ghosts of his past to come to haunt him. He turned to Sparrow, and she seemed to see the truth in his eyes, because she nodded and said, "Go, I will command the defenses." Mortis moved north through the quiet forest. The stalwart trees were his only companions, and he brushed each one with his fingertips as he passed. His other hand gripped his axe. Not too hard or soft, and even after all these years, the instrument felt as comfortable in his fist as an extension of his arm. A sound, a soft thump, dragged his attention to the side. An oar panther stared at him in the dark. A decade ago he would have screamed and run. Now, he said, "Go. The Orions have need of you on this night." Though he knew it was a foolish idea, he thought he saw the iron-sheathed animal nod slightly in his direction, before bounding away. He continued on, and once more the silence was broken, this time by shouts. The battle had begun. That thought led to another. What am I doing? He'd vowed to stand with the Aurians, to fight alongside them, and yet here he was, alone in the forest. All for what? Revenge? Justice? Was that true? Even Mortis didn't know any more. But he did know that he couldn't turn back. The circle of his life had seemed to lead him around a curving arc all the way back to this point, the beginning. And if he didn't face his demons now, he didn't know if he could go on living at all. The axe suddenly felt heavier in his grip. The forest ended, the dark expanse of the eastern plains rolling out before him. To the southwest, he could see spots of fire that indicated torches. Shapes moved in the darkness, steel glinting under the moon's light, darting through the cloud cover. Specks of fire shot through the air like a swarm of bees. Fire arrows, he thought. Fools. In their forest of metal, the Aurians did not fear any kind of flame, save dragon fire. Still, arrows, whether inflamed or not, could still kill, and he held his breath. Hundreds of clanks reached his ears as the arrowheads hit the shielding he and Sparrow had designed. There was something satisfying about the sound, but he feared it wouldn't be enough. Drawing a deep breath, he emerged from the trees, running across the plains, his footfalls muffled. The connections between each portion of his armor were so fine that they didn't clank or shriek. He was a ghost. As he approached the mass of the Western Army, he pushed further westward, squinting to locate the end of their lines. He had to find the back, for that was where his target would be, likely protected by his own guard, none of whom would be expecting an attack at this point in the battle. When the lines of infantry ended, he saw larger shapes. They pranced proudly, well-trained horses carrying the lords of war. Mortis passed them, too, until there was naught but a single group moving at the rear. None rode horses, as even that would provide too bold a target for a craven man like Farley. Mortis turned southward, gripping his axe harder. Flashes of memory traded with a night interspersed with shadow and flame and steel. Offering a mischievous smile that warmed his cheeks, Scarlet hefted the axe, his axe, over her shoulder, letting it hover for a bare moment before bringing it down with a satisfying whoomp. The split halves of the log clattered away, and she grinned. Shadows moved across the plains. Swords moved, too, but not threateningly. Held, but not at the ready. Not yet. Mortis searched between the men, between the weapons, his gaze trying to find something to confirm his prey among them. Pink lips, so close now, his heart beating faster, colliding with them like two storms meeting in a fury, tasting them like air, breathing her in, never wanting the moment to end. For it was a first kiss, and first kisses should last forever. He was a shadow himself, and none saw him. Not yet. A snatch of gold amongst steel. A face of nightmares, a face of pain, a face of hate and vengeance. Clad in armor, the man had aged somewhat, but still held the arrogant stance of one who was untouchable, who had never been deprived of anything he had wanted. He wasn't even wearing his helmet, holding it under one arm casually. He doesn't expect to fight. He expects the battle to be over before it ever reaches him. Think again. Lord Farley Loren had come to Mortis Ironclad. Opening the door, worried now, scanning the room, seeing her crumpled form, seeing the blood falling, falling. Knees hitting the floor, but not feeling the slash of pain judder through his bones. Her body still warm, so warm she had to still be alive, save for that vacant stare from those beguiling eyes he once could have gazed into for all of eternity, never growing bored. Something took over Mortis, something animal, and he leapt forward, all thoughts of stealth vanishing in that final memory. The first guard didn't even make a sound, except for a surprised, sharp intake of breath, but by then it was too late. He fell with the clatter of armor, but by then Mortis was already moving on to the next guard, who was paper under the edge of his magnificent axe. Mortis was vaguely aware of a strange sound, a guttural cry, but he'd killed another two guards before he realized it was coming from him, scraping from the back of his throat as he turned toward the last of the guards. He didn't care, for the adrenaline was firing through him, and he was not man, nor animal, nor spirit any more. He was heat. He was sadness. He was vengeance. The man didn't